This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. If you click from channel to channel while watching the confirmation hearings of Chief Justice nominee John Roberts this week, frankly, it all may tend to look alike, whether they're splitting the screen between a questioning senator and a nodding Roberts, or an answering Roberts and a listening senator. But what do we learn from watching these hearings? Brooke Barnett is an assistant professor of communications at Elon University who has been considering this very question, and she joins us now by phone. Welcome back to The State of Things, Brooke.
Thank you for having me.
Hi. Well, first of all, who is really watching these confirmation hearings that started yesterday and are running through much of the week?
Well, we don't know much about the audience simply because it's too soon to know. So it's going to be hard to tell. I mean, the speculation clearly is that policy wonks and people highly interested in this topic are watching, you know, the ongoing coverage, you know, sitting down and watching hours of this. The rest of the people are probably surveying it through the media coverage. And clearly, we're seeing less news coverage because of the heavy focus on the aftermath of the hurricane. So perhaps there will be less media attention and less scrutiny of what is being said in these hearings because the news cycle has taken the attention elsewhere.
So is the public somewhat oblivious to what is going on there at those hearings?
I don't know necessarily if that's the case. I guess I would say the role of the media in terms of the public and the information it provides in this specific instance, I think, is that it gives some access to the court. The Supreme Court is so far removed from the public. This is a way for the American people to know more about this process. And I think, you know, that's clearly valuable. It does lead to an area, I think, that could make the court more accessible to the people, and that is the issue of cameras in the courtroom. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, in her memoir, said the Supreme Court is not a bad place from which to get some sense of the nation's concerns, but yet the general public is quite removed from anything that actually happens in that court. And, you know, television journalists, for example, for years have tried to cover inside the Supreme Court to no avail. So, you know, allowing some coverage in the Supreme Court would help educate the public and offer this perspective. You know, now hearing John Roberts in these confirmation hearings live discussing some of these issues, if confirmed to the Supreme Court, it may be the last time we hear him in that kind of context talking about those types of things. And the classic arguments against cameras in the courtrooms, you know, don't apply at the Supreme Court. So some argue that cameras would cause showboating among the lawyers. Well, anyone who's ever seen a Supreme Court argument knows that that's going to happen anyhow. They argue maybe that it'll affect the jury or the witnesses, but the Supreme Court doesn't have any of these. So, you know, John Roberts is replacing a justice that strongly opposed allowing cameras in the courtroom, and it'll be interesting to see if confirmed if he lessens some of those rules and allows the public to have more access. But right now, this is the only access to what happened.
I wonder if that's one of those questions that he would choose not to answer if asked at the confirmation hearings.
It would be interesting to see.
Do you, John Roberts, favor having live coverage from the Supreme Court?
That's right. One thing we do know, you know, as media scholars, we will eventually look at the audience and how the audience has perceived this specific media event and look at the effects. But generally, we can apply the notion of agenda setting to this, and that is simply the notion that the media do not tell people what to think, but rather what to think about. So because of this media coverage, folks will be talking about the Supreme Court and the issues before it in a way that they wouldn't be had the media not, you know, shown that flashlight on this issue.
Mm. And again, this is that rare opportunity for them to see the players, to see an actual person who might be a Supreme Court justice speak publicly at length about issues, or perhaps deflect questions about those issues.
But which also is, I guess, the other legal argument against the camera in the courtroom, and that is simply that anonymity, that letting the public get closer sort of makes this seem less like an apolitical group making these decisions, and this powerful anonymity would undermine maybe sort of the mystique of the court. And I know that that was one of the things that Rehnquist said. He said it would lessen the mystique and moral authority of the Supreme Court to have people near it. Now, as a former journalist and mass communication professor, I say information about the court and the people being near it can only be a positive thing.
Mm. It's an interesting question about having cameras in the courtroom, because they have had, in recent years, they have allowed the taping of certain sessions of the Supreme Court, audio taping of them at the very least.
That's correct. And the first time that happened, of course, was in the case that ended up essentially, in essence, deciding the election in 2000, and also with the University of Michigan affirmative action case, what's interesting is, given that access, and I don't know if this speaks more about the lack of audience interest or possibly the lack of press attention or media interest, but the press didn't do a whole lot with it. C-SPAN ran 2 hours of the audio tapes from the University of Michigan tape case. NPR did a 30-minute special, did some lengthy segments in some of their news coverage, but generally you had the one or two sentence audio clip, and then and then eventually, of course, reporting on the outcome of the case. So, even given the access, it wasn't unprecedented access. Like let's hear every oral argument or something. But given some nice day of access to the tapes, I'm not sure the press took advantage of that either. And we've seen a decline in Supreme Court reporters for newspapers, and I don't know if that's driven by the market. People aren't interested in what's happening on the Supreme Court, or if people just don't know enough about what's happening to know what might be interesting there.
Yeah. Well, getting back to the hearings that are taking place right now, do you think that Americans expect something specific to happen at these hearings after the case that took place 14 years ago, Clarence Thomas hearings?
Well, and of course, the Clarence Thomas hearings, no matter your political disposition, they were a media spectacle. So this was like a soap opera happening. And, of course, people have different determinations of whether this was effective, if this was democracy at work or not. But from the media side, this was highly entertaining television. And, Justice Rehnquist, maybe this is what he's trying to prevent, or was trying to prevent, in terms of having, the media be involved, that sort of circus atmosphere. In the end, did important information come out from those? Yes, it did. This time around, I'm sure these are going to seem quite dull, as have others, since then. The 93 confirmation of Justice Ginsburg would seem quite dull compared to what happened there. So, people tuning in to expect something like happened in the Clarence Thomas hearings clearly won't be finding it.
And finally, I question about those hearings. Was the information that was revealed, was that something that was dug up at the hearings themselves, or was that something that the media had found in the case of Clarence Thomas? And so was the hearing just, I guess, anticlimactic in that way?
Yeah, well, the press are clearly players in the type of information that forms the questions. And I think what's interesting in this case is you're seeing, a direct appeal in television ads from political interest groups saying, call your senator and tell them to ask this question. And so you're really seeing almost like a direct sell to the public to get involved in this process for certain political views. Make sure that John Roberts answers these 10 questions. And if you, Google search John Roberts and confirmation process, you'll get all these sites where people are saying the 10 things nobody will ask but they should. And so the way that, even the internet has facilitated, sort of maybe grassroots approach to getting your question out there to a senator to be asked of John Roberts is intriguing and probably, quite different than we had in 93 or prior.
Well, Brooke Barnett, thank you for being with us again.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Brooke Barnett is an assistant professor of communications at Elon University. We are talking about the ongoing hearings for John Roberts, the nominee to be Chief Justice of the United States. We are now in day two of those hearings. And with us now to discuss what the hearings will or will not accomplish are Michael Gerhardt. He is a professor of constitutional law at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and is here in the studio. Welcome.
Hi.
And Lyle Denniston has covered the Supreme Court for the Boston Globe and Baltimore Sun, among other papers, and joins us by phone. Hi there, Lyle Denniston.
Good afternoon.
Hi there. Well, Lyle Denniston, this is the 19th Supreme Court justice confirmation hearing that you have covered. Is there anything about the Roberts confirmation hearing that makes it stand apart from the others for you?
Well, I think it's most evident that the political polarization that now is so evident in the Senate and in our politics generally has intensified since the last Supreme Court hearings in 1994 when Justice Breyer was nominated and confirmed. I think the political venom flows more freely now than it did then, and the two sides of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the two partisan sides, are further apart than they were before, and so you're getting an emotional intensity to the debate that's going on within the Senate and within the committee that is much much more evident than it was the last time around. I think that's the principal thing. John Roberts is probably the best Supreme Court nominee witness that I've seen in quite a number, including the last several. He's superbly prepared, and he's obviously very adept at answering questions without answering questions.
Well, you mentioned political venom flowing there, but I wonder if the fangs don't get into the nominee. I mean, if they can't really, get him, make him. He seems unflappable in that regard, and there might be venom flowing all around, but he's not getting bitten.
Well, and it's one thing that's very evident, particularly in his somewhat testy exchange with Senator Kennedy this morning's session of the hearing. John Roberts is entirely capable of holding his own, particularly with senators who, it is my observation, are nowhere nearly as well prepared for this as John Roberts is. And he is. I think you could see in that exchange with Senator Kennedy that he is, while a gentleman, he is not going to allow a distortion of the documentary background that is before the committee about his work in the Reagan and first Bush administration. So he's capable of handling both the substantive material that's being discussed here as well as the emotional jousting that's clearly going to go on.
So Michael Gerhardt, oddly then, would the person who is the witness be sitting better than those people who are questioning him?
Well, the witness is, of course, in charge of or has control over the things he says and doesn't say. And there's one thing that helps John Roberts in that regard besides his considerable ability as a oral advocate, and that's the numbers in the Senate. With 55 Republicans, John Roberts knows that he has this pretty much in the bag as long as he doesn't sort of trip over himself or make any mistakes. So he's got an incentive to be quiet. He's got an incentive to try and keep things uninteresting, to keep as quiet or as non-forthcoming as possible. And, of course, he's very able to do that. But he's got a degree of confidence that some witnesses in the past might not have had because the numbers didn't favor them so much.
It's his to lose.
Yes, I think it's very much his to lose. And given the fact that he can distinguish his record fairly easily, he can put it aside by saying, I produced all that work while working in the Justice Department at the direction of somebody else, gives him a further advantage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What are the issues? Do you think this is going to be settled on issues, or is it just going to come down to those numbers that he knows he has 55 votes? So
it's my opinion, it'll largely come down to the numbers. I think that when a nominee comes before the committee and comes before the Senate, and the president's party controls the Senate, in a sense, there is what we might refer to as a presumption of confirmation. In other words, everything sort of seems to be working in that direction. That doesn't guarantee success. But it does, I think, at least create the possibility that the nominee can take advantage of that. And John Roberts has one other advantage we haven't really mentioned, and that is he doesn't have the sort of written paper trail of a Robert Bork or Clarence Thomas. He doesn't have a lot of law review articles out there in which he was talking about controversial issues in a controversial way. To the extent he's got controversial statements out there, they are in official memoranda that, again, as I mentioned before, he can just explain away by saying, I produce those at the direction of somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Lyle Denniston, is there any chance in your mind that Roberts will not be confirmed?
No. The caveat that we always throw in is barring the discovery of some scandal, given the kind of public and private rectitude that is so evident about John Roberts personally and about his professional career, the chances that we will have somebody like an Anita Hill coming forth with a scandalous accusation or revelation seems really quite remote. So the numbers, as Mike has just said, the numbers are very powerfully in Roberts' favor. I think John Roberts does see this as an opportunity to engage in a really serious exchange. It's unfortunate, perhaps, that many commentators, at least, are suggesting that his principal purpose is evasion. I think if that is one of his purposes, I think he also has an additional purpose, and that is to put on display the kind of modesty and humility that he expects, in fact, is planning to indulge if he becomes the Chief Justice of the United States. I think John Roberts is using this as a forum to provide an exhibit of a future member of the Supreme Court who's going to conduct himself in a particular fashion, and at least the portrait that he is giving us, the self-portrait that he's putting before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and in fact before the country because of the television audience, assuming some people are watching it, is a quite commendable one.
One issue that was in the forefront in this morning's session, issue of abortion, which rests, and the Roe v. Wade decision, which rests on the idea of a right to privacy. In the past, John Roberts said in some writing or other, in the past he had called it the so-called right to privacy, but this morning he said, and I'm quoting here, "I do think the right to privacy is protected under the Constitution in various ways." So, Michael Gerhardt, is that the kind of thing that he would say at a confirmation hearing that could come back to haunt him if he decides in a case that seems to go counter to that? Or does it matter what he says at the confirmation hearings when he's making a decision as the Chief Justice of the United States, one of nine votes?
What he says at the hearings will matter a great deal. I think, in fact, one of the things we do discover if we look at the hearings closely in the past is that nominees have actually hewed pretty closely to what they revealed about themselves in prior hearings. And John Roberts chooses his words carefully. He can recognize a right to privacy as protected by various provisions of the Constitution that doesn't in any way lock him into any particular position in a given case. He knows that. He will not talk about specifics or a given case. And the other thing about John Roberts, I think, statements is that I think he can give some things away. In a sense, he can sort of make some concessions, uncontroversial concessions, like saying basically in the year 2005, I acknowledge that there's a right of privacy protected by some parts of the Constitution, partly because that's the right of privacy, if it ever does come before him, is not likely to come before him in some general way. It's likely to come before him in some specific way. And as he's already said, he'll deal with those specifics when they come before him.
As somebody trained in law, would you have wanted to have somebody who's on the Senate press him more about when he says, I do think the right to privacy is protected under the Constitution in various ways, to say, well, what are those various ways?
Yes, I think the follow-up questions oftentimes are the best ones. You can expect that John Roberts is, of course, going to be well-versed and quite smart and know the law very well. The other thing I just might point out about it is we've seen this sort of an evolution in the discussion of Republican judicial nominees on their philosophies. In the 1980s, Republican judicial nominees talked about their philosophies as commitments to originalism and judicial restraint. Now we see them using different metaphors. Now they talk about judging as if it's baseball. Now they talk about judicial modesty. And it's interesting to think about why that evolution took place. The reason I think it took place is because those other nominees got in trouble. John Roberts is also introducing new terminology here. Republicans are trying out a new strategy for getting their nominees through the Judiciary Committee.
And the reference to baseball, I'm the referee, not somebody who's batting or pitching.
Yes, they figure that that's a nice, neutral, appealing analogy that doesn't commit them in any particular way once they get on the court.
However, Lyle Denniston, and when I heard that yesterday, I was thinking that, well, yeah, but sometimes a referee's call can certainly change the outcome of a game. And that's is that not what this is all about here?
Well, I think that continuing the baseball analogy is useful, particularly because while John Roberts is right that you don't go to a game to watch the umpire, when the umpire is making a disputed or controversial call, you pay very close attention to what the referee or umpire has done. And I think it's quite clear that that Judge Roberts realizes that when he is a member of the Supreme Court and as the Chief Justice, there will be times when the calls that he will make will be calls that he can make within a fairly wide area of juridical discretion, that he's going to be able to make choices that he's not so tightly and mechanically bound by prior rulings that he doesn't have any room for judicial maneuvering. So I think it's pretty clear that as an umpire, John Roberts will not be a mechanistic kind of judge. I was interested in Mike's comment about judges talking about themselves as originalist. In Judge Roberts' exchange late this morning with Senator Grassley of Iowa, he in effect described himself as an originalist, But he did so in a very interesting way. He said that...
Well, we're going to have to get back to the interesting way in a moment, but we'll continue our conversation shortly with Lyle Denniston and Mike Gerhart talking about the hearings underway right now for John Roberts. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava, and we are talking this hour about the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of nominee John Roberts, who has been nominated to be Chief Justice of the United States. With us are Supreme Court reporter, longtime Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston and Michael Gerhart, a professor of constitutional law at UNC Chapel Hill. Just before the break, you're interrupted there by the break, Lyle Denniston. You were talking about how John Roberts was identifying himself in this morning's hearings at the U.S. Senate.
Well, he was suggesting to Senator Grassley of Iowa that you can be an originalist, and I think he was describing himself, though he didn't say it in that specific way, if you look at what the words say and whether or not those words have an expansive scope to them and are not strictly applicable to the problem or the evil that was being solved at the time those words were penned and put into the Constitution. And that is a very interesting way of describing originalism, because you're focusing very tightly on the text, but you're focusing on the scope of that text, and that allows you, I think, quite often to interpret the Constitution in a way that considers it to be a kind of a living document, because the breadth of the words allows you to look beyond the context of the moment when they were passed. And that, I think that's an interesting revelation about his views, and I think it's a quite interesting revelation about the approach that he is likely to take.
What of the role of the hearings in general? You are a veteran of covering these, 19, if I recall. Do they serve a purpose for the general public, for the Senate, or is the information they need about the candidate, the nominee for the Supreme Court, pretty much out there before these hearings come along? And if you have hearings where the nominee is going to say, well, I can't answer that because that could be a case that comes before me in the court, are they empty of content then?
Well, I think they are an interesting thing to watch, but only if you have a really close interest in the substantive work of the court, or secondarily, you have close interest in the operation of national politics. Because what's going on here simultaneously is a kind of a legal/constitutional seminar in which substantive issues that have come before the court and are likely to come again in new guises before the court are being discussed. But at the same time, you're having an active political drama unfold here over one of the most important powers that the president, together with the Senate, have to use, and so it is a good show. The difficulty, I think, for the country as a whole in terms of whether or not it's really meaningful is how widely are these being watched. And I suspect that that the audience for these hearings probably was fairly large for a part of yesterday when Judge Roberts was appearing, and maybe intermittently somewhat impressive in numbers as the questioning goes on. But I suspect that as this day in particular unfolds, with the hearing running into the early evening, that you're going to find people in general sort of edging away from their television set or switching channels. So it's a great exercise in civics, both about the Supreme Court and about the role of politics in trying to shape the future of the judiciary. And frankly, I wish that more people were probably watching, but I'm afraid they probably aren't.
Right. Well, Michael Gerhart, for you, the question is, if someone such as John Roberts has the numbers on his side, 55 votes, clear majority that he needs to get the nomination, become the Chief Justice, what would he have to lose by saying, these are my views on these issues? Because after all, he'd get the nomination, would he not? There are people probably of rather like mind who would be voting for him. He has those votes locked up. It's a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court. Why not say, these are my views on abortion, death penalty, these particular issues?
Well, the two possible answers. One is, of course, like any judicial nominee, he's going to be reluctant to talk about issues likely to come before him. In fact, some of these issues are pending in the court's docket right now. And under judicial canons and practices, he doesn't want to appear to be committing himself to a position before the actual arguments in the case are made. So that's one time-tested sort of reason for it. But the second is, as you just mentioned, he's got the votes locked up. And he's got those votes locked up in part because particularly Republican senators are convinced or persuaded or believe that he's a certain kind of nominee. So he has no incentive to dissuade them from that belief or position. Instead, he'll try and keep them together. And in terms of the Democrats, all he's got to do really is keep them from filibustering him. And if he can do that little, so to speak, and do it eloquently, he is going to be confirmed as the 17th Chief Justice of the United States.
Okay. We are talking about the nature of Supreme Court justice confirmation hearings, John Roberts hearings, of course, underway this week. Now, there have been some of those justice nominees who surprised the country and the presidents who nominated them because the presidents may have thought they were getting one particular justice on the court, and the rulings that they made subsequently turned out to be rather different. One such judge, justice, is Supreme Court Justice David Souter. Joining us right now from his office at East Carolina University is political science professor Tinsley Yarbrough. Tinsley Yarbrough is author of several books about the Supreme Court. His latest is David Hackett Souter, Traditional Republican on the Rehnquist Court. Welcome, Tinsley Yarbrough. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Well, take us back to Justice Souter's confirmation hearings. This is a case of a Republican nominee who has turned out not to hew with the conservatives on the court, much to the surprise of the president who nominated him.
Well, I think as his hearings began, there was great uncertainty as to whether he had the qualifications to be on the highest court in the nation. And then in the hearings, I think he was, though this is not a usual term for Justice Souter, he was dazzling in his treatment of the questions and in his responses. But I think that what the first President Bush wanted to do most in picking Justice Souter at the recommendation of others, including John Sununu of New Hampshire's chief of staff, was to pick a person without a paper trail, a stealth candidate who could avoid some of the problems that Robert Bork faced. But there's a risk of that too. If you get someone like that and don't pay a lot of attention to the record that is there, then you may end up with a justice who goes his own way. And my own view is that had his decisions as a New Hampshire jurist been closely probed, it would have been pretty clear that he was not going to be in the Scalia-Rehnquist-Thomas mold.
Mm. What are some examples? Can you give us an example of an issue or a case in which David Souter's opinions as a Supreme Court justice came as quite a surprise to the Bush administration, the first President Bush's administration?
Well, I think many of them have. He is a jurist in the mold of the second Justice Harlan, another biographical subject of mine. And Justice Harlan was essentially a common law justice who believed in the creative role of judges when they are interpreting constitutional provisions, but also believed very deeply in precedent, even precedents that he did not agree with. And Justice Souter is in that mold, and lots of the precedents that he has dealt with have been precedents that go back to the Warren Court period, or precedents from the Berger Court that were pretty liberal in scope, and he has simply been perfectly willing to adhere to those precedents and reluctant to see them dismissed in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992. He formed a group of three justices to retain at least the essence of Roe v. Wade, and he was among those justices the most concerned that a precedent of such long standing as Roe not simply be dropped. And I think that grew out of his essentially common law approach to judging and this commitment to the stability of law in the form of earlier precedent.
And finally, are there other justices on the Supreme Court, who have provided a surprise to those who nominated them?
Well, I'm not certain that there have been any of those. Breyer and Ginsburg, I imagine, have not been a surprise to President Clinton. And I'm not certain what was in President Ford's mind when Justice Stevens was picked. But I imagine that they figured that Justice Stevens would be relatively middle of the road, probably not as liberal as he has been as a justice. But I don't know that President Ford, unlike President Reagan and President Bush, I don't know that President Ford was all that committed to ideology in the selection process.
Do you think that John Roberts could provide a similar surprise to the current President Bush as David Souter did to his father?
He could, but looking at the record thus far, I could see him as fitting rather neatly into the mold of Rehnquist and Scalia and Thomas. I think it'd be really a long shot to expect that he would be as flexible, for example, as Justice O'Connor. She obviously, when she was picked by the Reagan administration, was picked primarily because of her gender. I'm sure, though, they respected her conservative credentials, but there was evidence there already that she might be hard to pin down on certain issues, such as the abortion issue. In fact, anti-abortion groups were her staunchest opponents in the confirmation proceedings in her case.
Well, Tinsley Yarbrough, thank you for being with us.
It was a pleasure.
Tinsley Yarbrough is a professor of political science at East Carolina University. He is also author of several books about the U.S. Supreme Court. The latest is David Hackett Souter, Traditional Republican on the Rehnquist Court. With us are Michael Gerhardt, professor of constitutional law at UNC Chapel Hill, and Lyle Denniston, who has covered the Supreme Court for years. Michael Gerhardt, you wanted to jump in there.
Well, I think what Professor Yarbrough said was quite interesting, in part because I think it shows us how the past has framed both the choice of John Roberts and framed these hearings. He mentioned that David Souter had sort of two distinguishing traits. One was that he was committed to kind of a creative role of justices in interpreting the Constitution. The other was respect for precedent. And we can already see how John Roberts completely rejects the first of those. There's nothing about anything he said or ever done to suggest he believes in or would be happy participating in being creative in interpreting the Constitution. If anything, as he keeps saying, he'd be modest in interpreting the Constitution. Secondly, we have heard him express a commitment to precedent, a respect for precedent. But, of course, we don't really know what that means when the rubber hits the road.
Mm-hmm. Lyle Denniston, Democrats in the Senate have been trying to get the release of papers that John Roberts had been a part of when he worked in the Bush administration, legal papers that he had filed. Much chance of them getting those released? And would they reveal much about the man, do you think?
To answer your latter question first, I'm not sure they would reveal any more except somewhat later advancement or modification of his political philosophies and his approach to the law as an advocate for a client, the United States government. I don't think there's a whole lot more there to reveal than has been in the memos from his service in the White House and the Justice Department. As to the other question as to whether they will get them, I think there's almost no chance now that they would release anything more. Because the hearings have actually begun, the questioning has begun, and a number of senators, particularly Democrats, would want to sort of have another round of questioning if they got additional documents. And so the administration is going to continue to stand on what it considers to be an ethical principle, but I think the operating pragmatic consideration for the administration is, this is going well enough as it is, and as a matter of fact, it's going along fine. Let's not upset the schedule here by releasing additional hundreds or perhaps thousands of pages of documents that would allow the Democrats essentially to start all over. So I think that's a fight that's going to continue to be waged. The demand is going to continue to be asserted as this nomination goes to the floor for debate, but I don't think the administration has felt compelled to release them up to now in order to advance Roberts' chances, and so I think they will probably hold out probably throughout the remainder of the process, and those documents won't be released, even if they did have something in them that would be very revealing, which I would tend to doubt.
Okay. And Michael Gerhardt, what are some of the issues coming up when the Supreme Court does get back to work in October? Any cases of concern here in North Carolina?
Well, there are going to be all sorts of cases with national implications, and I'm sure they're going to affect North Carolina as well. There's a federal law involving partial birth abortion, which is up for a hearing before the Supreme Court, the constitutionality of that law. Obviously, if that law is upheld, that could have effect in this part of the country, or even if it's struck down, that would have an effect in part because it reaffirms Roe versus Wade. There are other cases as well involving the scope of federal authority with respect to the economy, protecting endangered species, also other cases involving the president's authority in wartime.
Okay. And one final question for you, and that is, how is the Chief Justice different from the rest? Because 2 weeks ago, John Roberts was only a nominee, for being a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. Now he's being nominated as Chief Justice after the death of William Rehnquist. Does the Chief Justice have more power than the others?
In short, yes. The Chief Justice has got very unique powers. He of course, is one of nine, so he casts only a single vote in any given case. But he can assign the opinion on whichever side of the case he's on. If he's in the majority, he can assign that opinion, determines who speaks for the court. If he's in the dissent, he can assign that opinion. He's also the principal defender of the judiciary in before Congress and other branches. And then lastly, he can make specialized appointments to tribunals. He is the face of the federal court system, in a sense, and also its principal spokesperson.
Okay. Well, thank you both for being with us today. Michael Gerhardt, professor of constitutional law at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Lyle Denniston, who has covered the Supreme Court for the Boston Globe and Baltimore Sun, among other papers, for years. Thank you both, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that's the state of things. If you have a comment about our program, you can send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Our team includes Corey Princell, Megan Davis, Robin Copley, Dave DeWitt, and Susan Davis. Thanks for listening. Support for the state of things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Melinda Pencava.